Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind the scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome to Behind the Knife. Today we're excited to have Dr. Charles Brunicardi with us. He's the prior Academic Surgical Congress president and a historian. He is the editor-in-chief of the world's leading general surgery text, that's Schwartz's Principle of Surgery, and he's the chief of general surgery and vice chair for surgical services at UCLA Center for Gastrointestinal Disease. He's also a renowned artist and has a folk country music album out that was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in Music. Dr. Brunicardi, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Brunicardi, we had you on once before discussing the ASC conference and, you know, the anniversary this year. And we're happy to say, I don't know if you've heard, that Behind the Knife is going to make it down to the conference in Jacksonville this year.
Oh, that's great news.
Yeah,
it's a spectacular meeting.
I've heard.
The idea of the meeting is to help young academicians build their career. So we invite medical students, residents, and junior faculty, and we're all there to help them have a vision for what they want to do with their career, because they represent the future of surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to actually be doing some podcasts down there, too, so you might be get you another time on the Behind the Knife as well, if we can track you down while you're there.
Delighted.
So, Dr. Brunicardi, one of the questions we ask all our experts that come on Behind the Knife is, what first got you interested in medicine, and why did you become a physician?
So I wanted to be a doctor since I was 2 years old. I'm not sure where that came from, but it was all I ever was going to be, was be a doctor, until I got into med school. And then at that time in my life, I wanted to be a musician and tour.
Yeah.
Somehow I made it through med school. And then a year after med school, I dedicated myself to surgery, and decided that I was not meant to be a professional entertainer.
So can you tell us a little bit about, how from that point, from med school, where you did your fellowship, how you ended up at UCLA, and then a little bit about your current practice? You know, what's the majority of your practice now, and what's a typical week like for you?
Sure. I took a year off after med school to pursue entertainment. And so during that year, I made a decision to become a surgeon. And so I got an internship at a private hospital in San Francisco named Mount Zion. And then during that year, I decided I wanted to do academics. So I transferred into a university program, which was the State University of New York at Brooklyn. I was there for a total of 7 years and spent 3 years in the lab. After that, I was recruited by Mike Zinner to UCLA, where I was assistant associate professor. And then at the end of the fifth year, I was recruited to Baylor College of Medicine, where I became division chief and professor. And then within 3 years became the DeBakey professor and chairman of the department. I stayed there for 16 years, a total of 16, and then came back to UCLA. So I've been at UCLA for 10 and a half years total and was at Baylor College of Medicine for 16.
No, I want to hear more about the year you took off to pursue entertainment. What did you do during that year?
Well, I was supposed to be in a movie, the sequel to Saturday Night Fever. So I spent junior and senior year of med school training for that, dancing and singing in Manhattan and acting.
No way.
I had gone to the Juilliard School and the Juilliard School for acting, and then I did dancing with Ron Farella's company. So I trained. I was playing, singing, and dancing and acting in New York, and I decided to take a year off. And during that year, things didn't work out with the entertainment, but I was offered to do other entertainment projects. And I made a decision. Then John Lennon was shot on December 8th of that year. And he was my ultimate hero. And I made a decision that I did not want to be a professional entertainer, that my life was supposed to be dedicated to medicine. And so in the next few months, I made a decision to go into surgery. And then got back into surgery that July, and then that's, you know, I've dedicated myself to surgery for the past since 1981.
So do you ever look back and wonder what things have been like if you would have not made that decision and where you would have been in it now?
I'm actually very thankful I made the decision. I love surgery. It's an incredibly exciting field. It's the technology's changing. We talked a little bit about precision surgery and robotics and genomics and all, how all that's going to advance the field. So it's just been, I thought it was a great decision, and I've never looked back on that decision. What's interesting now is I'm making a lot of connections with people in the entertainment industry, and I've started recording again. So it's been really fun as a hobby, as opposed to having to depend on it as my career. So I feel like I have the best of both worlds right now.
So yeah, could you tell us a little bit about your music career? What instrument did you start playing? How did that develop? And when did you release your first album?
Okay, so I started when I was 7 years old. My father started all of us. There were four kids in the family. He started all of us playing and entertaining when we were seven. And so every week we had entertaining in the family. And then I made the all-county choir that year as well. So it was a big year. And all through high school, college, and med school, I was always singing and playing guitar. I play a number of instruments, but my main instrument is guitar, and then I sing. When I got to college, my best friend is Steve Gaskley. We formed a band called Rodeo Rick, and we played every Friday and Saturday night through college at some type of gig. And so I helped earn my way through college playing. And then I started writing songs, and we actually made our first album at the end of college. So we actually made an album. And then we kind of went our separate ways. And during med school, I had two record contracts, one with Charisma Records and one with RSO. And I toured England twice in the summer between freshman and sophomore year of med school. And then between sophomore and junior year of med school, I toured England and had the two record contracts. And so the biggest gig I ever did was the Cambridge Folk Festival, and I played in front of about 15,000 people, and that was very exciting. I got written up in the equivalent of their Rolling Stone magazine. I had a nice article. It was called the Melody Maker magazine. And so, like I said, during med school, all I wanted to do was be a singer-songwriter and perform.
Well, and for listeners, at the end of the podcast or a little bit later in the podcast, Dr. Brunicardi has been kind to allow us to feature some of his music. So we'll have some of his music during this podcast.
So when you are doing the stuff on stage, do you ever get stage fright? Did you ever remember a time where you messed up a song or forgot the lyrics or kind of had anything like that?
Well, we had a couple terrible gigs. One was in college where we played for a frat house and we were just terrible. It was just a bad night. And then there was another time I played with my father and brother and we were terrible at someone's wedding. So yeah, you go through those experiences. In terms of stage fright, yeah, you get nervous before you go on stage. That's part of it. But once you're on stage, it's like being in the operating room. You come alive and you feel this incredible energy. So it's exhilarating being on stage.
Now, Dr. Bricarni, the next thing we want to move into is discussing your current research. I know you've done a lot of work in the personalized genomic medicine and surgery. I know you mentioned before we started the podcast that you have some current research or grants that are in progress. Can you tell us a little about them?
Sure. We are working on actionable genes for pancreatic cancer. So most of the gene mutations that are associated with pancreatic cancer, we do not know how to take action on them. Whether that action means operating, putting them in a high-risk trial, targeted therapy, whatever it is, we don't know what to do with it. A classic example is the KRAS mutations, the G12, D, V, C mutations. We don't know what to do with those. So what we figured out is downstream to, let's say, KRAS and P53, SMAD4, are other genes that we can take action on. And so we figured out a way of taking action on them, and we have targeted screening, targeted imaging, and targeted therapy for pancreatic cancer that's working in mice. So it's a very, very exciting time for our research team. And what the goal now is to see if we can translate it from mice and working in the laboratory into actually phase one clinical trials. And so that's the goal of our team right now, is to make that transition.
And how do you
see that?
There's
a lot of young researchers that are out there that have this same type of translational medicine, and they have setbacks along the way that they think they're about to take that next leap, and then something comes out of it. What advice can you give to them when it's just like you think you're going to make that breakthrough, and all of a sudden you're like, it's just not working, and maybe you need to even start all the way over at the drawing board?
Yeah, I have two bits of advice, and we can expand upon this. Number one, if I did it, they can do it. I'm not that smart. The other piece of advice is persistence is the key. So when I started out in 1989 with my as an assistant professor, I was perfusing pancreases of humans and rats. And so it was basic physiology. And now what we're doing is somatic engineering of pancreatic cancer cells. So you say, how did that transition take place? Well, it's all persistence over a very long period of time.
Sir, one thing with the concept of your novel research, how are you identifying these patients, or at least what is the plan to identify these patients? Are these patients already diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, or patients that are high risk to make these interventions on?
Well, that's a great question. We hope that the therapies that we have will help patients with pancreatic cancer. So it would be all patients. We would hope our newest project is to define those who are at high risk for getting pancreatic cancer and see if we can identify them while they're still in the panic stage using our BRCA5 PREVENT technology. And so, like I said, we have that working in human cancers in mice. We're seeing if we can then begin testing patients with this to see if it works.
Now, for this, this personalized cancer treatment, just as a broad picture, how do you see this practically being implemented? Are we talking, like a cancer vaccine, or are we talking about more targeted therapies for patients to prevent recurrence postoperatively? Or are we talking in the neoadjuvant setting?
That's another great question. So we have out of our lab RNAi therapy And we're working with a company in Dallas, Texas, called Strike Bio, that has an RNAi platform. They also have a vaccine platform, but we're working with them on the RNAi platform. So the RNAi knocks down the target gene. So let's say the gene is BRK5. We then knock down BRK5 using RNAi therapy. So that's one thing. We then also have small molecules or drugs that would knock down these target genes. And so that's what the lab is working on right now. And it probably will be a hybrid of therapies, not just one therapy, that to really stop something like pancreatic cancer. I look at it like AIDS or even bad infections, where you would use triple antibiotics. And for AIDS, you use three drugs. I think the same thing will be necessary for pancreatic cancer, where you'll have to have at least three types of therapy, either knocking down a single target or three therapies knocking down three targets.
But I just had a question. You know, it's a difficult question to formulate, but you're working in research that's probably going to involve, to a large degree, private industry and the private sector. What are some of the challenges that you faced, or do you have any advice to people who are looking to do this type of research as far as lessons learned when trying to merge these two worlds, the academic scientific world and perhaps even, the private industry?
Well, first of all, the major challenge is finding out the right question to ask. So I remember hearing Judah Folkman say that after 30 years, he figured out what the right question was with angiogenesis. So the key is finding out what the right question is. In other words, what's the next step to take in research? And that just takes, unless someone's brilliant, it takes a lot of years of persistence to figure out what the next step is. In other words, what's the right hypothesis to pursue? The second challenge is funding the lab. And so everyone is struggling right now to fund their labs, because the NIH funding rate is about somewhere between 7 and 10%. So the question is, how does someone fund the lab? And so you have to have a diversified portfolio between peer review funding like the NIH and the VA merit review systems. You would have industrial support if you want to have industry support. And then you have to have private funding from foundations and grateful patients. And so I've always tried a diversity, to have a diverse portfolio to fund the lab. But year by year, it's an incredible struggle to fund the lab.
So is there, how did you get started doing this with, is it your own personal interest with pancreatic cancer? Is there something particular about pancreatic cancer that makes it more attractive to these types of therapies? Do you see this, in other, are you working on it with other types of cancers, or do you know of people that are?
Well, that's an interesting question. I started out studying islet physiology and insulin secretion. And so we made we found out that PDX1, which is pancreatic duodenal homeobox 1, was regulating insulin, and that we were able to target PDX1. So then during a lab meeting, I suggested to the team, can we look at PDX1 in pancreatic cancer? We actually were looking at it in insulinoma. And so the group tested it in pancreatic cancer cells, and it worked. So that was 1998. And that started us down the road of pancreatic cancer. So I believe our target, PDX1, is kind of the bridge between pancreatic cancer and diabetes. And so we've been pursuing both fields for the last 18 years.
Excellent. All right. Well, last question for our, you know, our dissection of the day, and probably the most important, is what's upcoming and what's next in your musical career?
We just released another a vinyl EP with four songs on it that was produced by Mario Caldano. And so I'm very excited about that. And then I would like to record again. We are recording a song about the Holocaust, about being a Holocaust survivor. And so I'm recording that with a sound designer named Eddie Kim. And Eddie just won the an Emmy for the Foo Fighters' Sonic Highways. And he did all of the sound engineering for that for Sonic Highways. Very impressive. So he and I have started recording this song called Harry's Curse. And so we hope to finish that this winter. And then I have to decide what's next. But I've really gotten interested in recording again. So I can do that in my spare time, let's say on the weekends, and record. And it's very creative recording. It reminds me of research in a lot of ways. And so that's become my hobby when I'm not working.
So where can people find? Do you have a website, or if people want to get the vinyl?
Yeah, people can go to chuckbrenicardi.com and they can listen to the CD called Where Sunset Meets the Beach. And then Devil and Angel is the new four-song vinyl EP. They can also find it on iTunes as well as Amazon, places like that.
Yeah, I was definitely just listening to it on Spotify, too. I don't know if you use that as well or not. But yeah, I think it has almost all your current songs on there, so it's good to find them there. But next point we're going to go into here, Dr. Brunicardi, is our tips and tricks segment of the day. This is the point of our podcast that we really dive into a specific surgery process that we can ask our experts some, you know, interesting ways of approaching the subject and surgical techniques that you could help the followers in their careers. That what we want to focus on today is pancreatic mass enucleation. So to start out, when you have a patient with presents with something like this, when is it appropriate to operate on these patients? When is enucleation appropriate, or when is resection?
Well, if you have a pancreatic cancer and adenocarcinoma, you should really do a formal resection. You can do that laparoscopically or even robotically. It's been safe and effective. But they really need, right now, they need a standard resection. And just as a little aside on that, we need better adjuvant therapy to prolong the survival after pancreatic resection. Now, if you have a benign tumor, so let's say you have an insulinoma, then enucleation is great. And so you can enucleate the tumor and cure the patient of it. Now, if it's a neuroendocrine tumor, now you get into a gray zone. Should they have a formal resection, or should they have a nucleation? And there's a great paper on that, a dialogue between Dr. Dana Anderson and Dr. Howard Reber that talk about the pros and cons of surgical resection versus enucleation. I believe you can enucleate safely for a neuroendocrine tumor if you get a nice margin on it. And so the question is, then what technique do you use to enucleate the tumor?
Exactly. So, Dr. Brunicardi, what technique do you use to enucleate the tumor?
Well, you can use the ligature. You could use a harmonic scalpel. And another interesting technique is to use the CUSA, in which you would enucleate using the CUSA as you would for a brain tumor. So all three of those techniques are excellent and cut down on blood loss.
How do you, any tips for avoiding a post-op pancreatic leak or avoiding an intraoperative ductal injury when you're doing an enucleation?
Yeah, I think using the ultrasound intraoperatively is a big help to see where the duct is located. So that would be a big help. If you think you've injured the duct, then you might want to put a piece of jejunum and doing anastomosis. And it seems that no matter, I always like to leave a drain. That's another big question, whether you should leave a drain or not. And Bill Fisher out of the Elkins Pancreas Center in Houston is working on studying the use of drains in pancreatic cancer. I still use a drain. It seems to me that no matter what we do with the pancreas, there seems to be about a 10% pancreatic fistula rate. And so it's something we have to deal with. I think placing a drain is the best way to deal with it.
And how do you decide when to take that drain out postoperatively?
When the fluid drops down to a certain level, let's say below 30 or 40 a day, and you usually leave it in for a couple weeks if there's any type of leak, and you want to make sure that the drain is walled off. And then I also will take the drain off suction and put it through a bile bag, gravity drainage, and that will also frequently help cut down on the amount that comes out.
Any role for checking, postoperative drain amylase levels or anything like that?
Yeah, you should check on that from time to time. If it's negative to begin with, then usually you don't have to check it again, but you could check it weekly if you like.
And, sir, can you tell us the name of that paper again that you referred to? We'll put that on our website at the tips and tricks section for our listeners to access.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and get the actual
just the author's
paper. I have
names
it in my files. Yeah.
Okay, great.
And last question on the subject. So a young 30-year-old female with a, say, a 2-centimeter non-functioning neuroendocrine tumor of the head of the pancreas, are you going to resect that or enucleate it?
I think if it's in a safe location, I would go for enucleation with a good margin on it.
Excellent. All right. Well, that does it for our tips and tricks.
And now this leads us into our final five. And Dr. Brunicardi, since we are lucky enough to have you on the podcast before, we have a modified final five. So okay. Our first one, and my personal favorite, is number one. What was your first car?
I had a 1963 Bonneville, a Pontiac Bonneville with a 421 engine. It was a hand-me-down from my dad.
All right, number two, if you could think back to when you were an intern, do you remember your very first surgical case?
Well, I can tell you the case that I was left alone in, which was my first case as a surgeon. It was a 2-year-old with a burn on his leg. And the attending said, I have an emergency, I have to go. And so he left me in the OR all by myself, and I did the skin graft on the 2-year-old. And it was just absolutely exhilarating experience. I didn't know whether I'd be able to do it or not, but I just did what I was taught step by step, and I got the operation done, and the patient did well.
All right. Question number three, when you were in medical school or, early residency, who was your surgical mentor?
My surgical mentor is Dana Anderson at Downstate. And to this day, he is still my main mentor. I call him and talk with him all the time. I would say several times a month. I ask him clinical advice and research advice. And so, that relationship has been going on since 1981.
Number four, if you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be and why?
I would have dinner with Mr. Jerry Moss.
Who is that?
Jerry Moss is the founder of A&M Records. He's the M in A&M Records, and I hold the Moss chair. And when we have dinner, we just have a great time talking about the history of rock and roll. Because he was a pioneer in rock and roll from the late 1950s and has lived through every transition and just is a wealth of information on rock and roll and popular music.
Awesome. Our last question, number five, we actually had to change this question. It was supposed to be, who is your favorite band or artist? But we all knew you would say John Lennon. So we changed it to be, what's your favorite band or artist from the last 5 years?
I would have to say Bon Iver.
Oh, yeah.
The Bon Iver album is absolutely spectacular. If I had gone into music, I probably would have been a producer, because the producer creates the sound of the album. It's like a director of a movie. And that album is absolutely spectacular, and the production is just phenomenal. Yep. And if you really listen to the lyrics, I've analyzed the lyrics. I don't understand what he's saying. The words don't make any sense to me, yet they give this phenomenal image. The imagery is just outstanding, and the music's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. That's a fantastic album, one of my favorites as well.
Well, Dr. Brunicardi, we can't thank you enough for joining us behind the knife. And right after we close out with you, we're going to close out with one of your songs, and I'm sure listeners will really enjoy that. And we look forward to seeing you in Jacksonville in just over
Great.
A couple of months here. And thank you again for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Well, I'm honored to have been interviewed, so I can't thank you enough.
Well, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. A few things to note, we do have some upcoming episodes, and the first one is on advice for new chiefs, and then we'll hopefully have a few more episodes on advice for new interns as well. And to close it all out, here is Dr. Charles Brunicardi, or Chuck Brunicardi as a stage name, singing Never a Father.
Until next time, dominate the day.
I was never a father. Times I wish I was one. From the unknown he was sired. I would raise him as my son. I would throw him on my shoulder. We would walk down to the sea. Felt his weight as he grew older. A million questions for me. There was something in this young man I had never seen before. He was being driven by some haunting silent soul. If I asked him of his visions, he would turn and shake his head, as if he didn't know the answer, or that it was better left unsaid. Never a father, but I'm glad I wasn't one. The crushing pains and the sorrows when you lose your only son. He hugged me and I said goodbye, son. He turned so I wouldn't see the watched him fade on the horizon. His
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes, subject to driver availability. More terms apply.